Okay, good morning, everybody, and thanks, Ian, for introducing me to Dare. I must confess, listening to the list of companies I've worked for made me realize I'm actually getting quite old. But I'm delighted to be addressing you at the start of what I think promises to be a very interesting day, extremely informative, and I hope that you're going to find it worthwhile. The day's sessions have deliberately been set up to focus on planning practice and affordable housing, as Ian said, rightly concentrating on the most important issues facing the government and, of course, the industry. I'm also delighted to be here in Milton Keynes, a thoroughly appropriate place, it seemed to me, in which to hold our annual planning conference. I say that not only because Milton Keynes is one of the four major growth areas in the southeast of England, set, as you all know, to accommodate another 28,000 homes by 2011, nor because the growth of Milton Keynes in recent years demonstrates the very best that our industry is capable of doing in terms of design, sustainability, and customer satisfaction. Now, I say it because it occurred to me on the way up that Milton Keynes is only about 5 miles away from Bletchley Park. I don't know how many of you know the significance of Bletchley Park, but it's the collection of buildings that during the Second World War housed Britain's finest code-breaking minds. And in a quiet moment of reflection on the train, I wondered what those brilliant team of young men and women would make of today's building and planning regulation system. And it occurred to me that perhaps we could do with some of their talents from time to time. What I want to do by way of introduction this morning is set out my view on the context in which both policymakers and our industry needs to work. If we fail to collectively understand that, then I believe the social and economic consequences will be profound. The spirit of our times can perhaps best be summed up in one word: aspiration. We aspire to be successful. We aspire to travel more, to have the latest gadgetry. And when talking about aspirations, few rank as high as home ownership. Surveys consistently show that around 90% of people aspire to own their own home. Both of the main political parties, of course, recognize this. There is a strong conviction in government, and yes, this is one that I believe is shared at both number 10 and number 11, that greater home ownership is a means of creating a fairer and more prosperous society. The government has pledged, as we know, to enable 1 million more households to become homeowners. And the Conservative Party is also committed to increasing home ownership. Just last month, at a conference on the challenges facing first-time buyers, David Cameron announced his commitment to, and I quote, extend massively the whole housing market and home ownership. These are strong words, and I'm delighted that Michael Gove, the Shadow Housing Minister, will be here later to give us some more information. And of course, house builders and lenders spend every day of their working lives trying to provide the means for people to achieve this aspiration. So how are we doing as a society in meeting those aspirations? About a year ago, the policy think tank Reform published a report that identified that today's young people, particularly young professional graduates, can be called the iPod generation. The term is used not because of the popularity of the digital musical device that so many of us use, but because it's the acronym of the words insecure, pressured, overtaxed, debt-ridden. The report gives us a sober analysis of the disadvantages facing today's younger generations. In particular, the authors of the report focused on the constraints on young people achieving their housing aspirations. Their findings, frankly, make depressing readings. Amongst them, affordability has deteriorated so that the average age of first-time buyers is now risen to 34. Owner-occupation rates have slumped amongst the younger households, with an increasing number of people now living with their parents into their 20s and even into their 30s. Those attempting to buy their first home have to raise a much larger deposit than earlier generations did, and they will have to face hefty rates of stamp duty as they struggle to climb the housing ladder. And those unable to buy have missed out on the massive rise in homeowners' wealth generated by the last house price boom. Less than a year on, there's little reason to suppose there's been much improvement. But on a more positive note, I think the problems faced by young people today in meeting their housing aspirations should help to create a more favourable climate for house builders and, I have to add, for planners. We know from our YouGov opinion poll last April that young people have a more realistic attitude towards balancing the need for new housing against a desire to protect greenfield land and people's unease about development generally. It's encouraging that politicians have recognised this shift and have begun to challenge those of us that are well housed to recognise that resisting development comes at a price paid by our children and by their children as they seek to achieve the same standard of housing that we aspire to at their age and generally subsequently attained. So we still have a long way to go, but I think at last we are beginning to travel in the right direction. The planning system, as we all know, you all know better than I, must take its share of the blame for the undersupply of housing over the last two decades or more. PPG 3, revised in March 2000, dictated a brownfield-first approach, and home builders are now delivering over 70% of all new housing on brownfield land. I don't actually have a problem with that. The simple fact is, however, that not enough land is coming through the planning system. The startling analysis is that if you go back to between 1997 and 2003, the total amount of land developed annually in England fell by 10%. And if you delve deeper into that analysis, what you find is that actually brownfield development land rose 9% and greenfield land fell by almost 30%. So the latest government projections forecast a rise of nearly 5 million households over the next 20 years, the supply of land on which we accommodate them is steadily being reduced. That is not a way, in my judgment, to meet everyone's aspirations. PPG 3 has also pushed up housing densities from a long-term average of around 25 dwellings per hectare to something around 40, just a little over 40 today. The result, of course, is that the industry has dramatically increased its output of smaller dwellings, primarily flats, and cut back equally sharply on the supply of conventional houses. Now, I have no problem with supplying flats, but we're failing to meet the needs of all the people across all of the market if we don't provide conventional houses as well. And it's little wonder, therefore, that Lord Rogers' Urban Task Force report, whilst noting the creation of an urban renaissance in Britain, of which we should all be justifiably proud, bemoaned the failure of cities to retain middle-class families. Families are being forced to look elsewhere, often in the second-hand market, because of a lack of appropriate options in new building. And I believe that we can't meet the government's housing target, and let's remind ourselves that's to increase home building to 200,000 homes a year by 2016, simply by pushing up densities higher and higher and cutting back the amount of development land that is coming through the system. To quote a much-used word, that approach will not be sustainable in the long run. Reinforcing that point, research that we commissioned shows that there is really no straightforward correlation between household size and the accommodation that people want to live in. Analysis by Professor David King, which we published about a year ago, showed that as we've become more affluent as a nation, we are living in homes with a larger number of rooms. It's a phenomenon of households of all sizes and all types, and means that the much vaunted increase in the number of smaller households will not automatically translate into a need for smaller homes. Quite the opposite. We will need more larger homes over the next 20 years if we're to provide today's younger generations with homes that meet their aspirations as they grow with families. Ultimately, if we don't provide sufficient homes of the right types in the right locations, younger people will pay the heaviest price. Older homeowners, already well housed in the majority of cases, will stay put. The under 45s, whether as first-time buyers or trading up to accommodate growing families, will find themselves squeezed by a shortage of homes and rising prices. Professor King's conclusion sounds an ominous note for the aspirations of young people. He said, and I quote, "Today's young people will be the first generation for nearly 100 years who will not be able to aspire to more spacious housing than their parents." This age of aspiration also, I believe, reframes the debate about affordable housing, which we're going to talk about this afternoon, an issue that unfortunately is not being addressed adequately, in our views, in the proposals for either a planning gain supplement or the draft planning policy statement 3. The subtle distinction between housing needs and housing aspirations in fact represents a significant policy shift. It moves the focus away from simply providing a safety net for the poor to finding mechanisms to enable all households to achieve the quality and size of dwelling to which they aspire. I therefore welcome the government's interest in how we can promote shared equity in property. And I'm interested also in David Cameron's proposal to look at ways in which people paying social rent might convert those payments into mortgage payments. And the HBF, as many of you will know, has convened a special working group to examine affordable housing. Paul Pedley of Redrow is chairing that group, which will review current policy and examine whether a new approach is needed. The industry must play a full part in finding and shaping policy solutions. We cannot simply leave this up to government. Now, the government, as we're all aware, is still consulting on draft PPS3, and that is an opportunity to realign housing policy with people's aspirations. The question, of course, remains how far the government proposals take us in that direction. Our test for the draft PPS3, therefore, focuses on one fundamental factor: whether it will assist in bringing forward more land for development so that we can build the right number of homes of the right types in the right locations. On that, we have two serious concerns. Firstly, it will not be possible for the industry to achieve the required increases in housing output if local planning authorities are allowed to specify house size, type, and affordability, though we understand why the government has toyed with that idea in its search for a policy which achieves mixed and balanced communities. And secondly, we think this is an opportunity that must be more fully utilised to discuss new models of affordable housing provision that reflect innovative industry practice and move away from a narrow focus on purely subsidised social housing. We have therefore called for continuing discussion with both the DCLG, local government, and the representatives of registered social landlords to ensure that the new policy is both deliverable and meets the country's overall housing needs. If we as an industry are calling for the government to ally its policy approach with the aspirations of the people it serves, we as an industry must play our part as well. Take the current focus on sustainability and climate change. We must closely factor into our thinking people's aspirations and their wish to exercise lifestyle choices. This issue is only going to grow and grow in importance. A February opinion poll by ICM makes interesting reading. 28% of respondents said that taking action to tackle climate change should be the government's top priority ahead of health, education, the economy, and so on. It is not only the government, therefore, that must respond to the spirit of the times. On the sustainability agenda, we are undoubtedly best placed to facilitate choice, to innovate, and to lead. And having just returned from a fact-finding visit to Holland, Denmark, and Sweden, accompanying Yvette Cooper, the housing minister, let me tell you that we are way behind on this. Way behind on this. But let me also tell you that we should not be frightened by this inevitable change. I saw nothing on my visit that we could not achieve in the UK, in many cases designed better, and nothing further which as a consumer would give me any particular concerns. It can be done in a customer-friendly fashion. And I did see zero-carbon houses. Equally, we as an industry must respond effectively, therefore, to that change. Under previous development plan processes, for example, the private sector made general objections to deposited plans and debated alternatives at public inquiries. The new system requires us to be totally involved throughout the policy-making process, from the very beginning to the very end. Grasp it and use it. We therefore need to adapt and to adjust. We cannot continue to blame local planning authorities alone for poor planning if, as an industry, we do not constructively respond to the new and expanding agenda by ensuring we play our part in speeding up the planning system and achieving better quality housing in well-designed communities. So to conclude, we're therefore at what I would call a crucial juncture. The government must remain in no doubt about what we consider to be the failings and inadequacies of PPG3 and our concerns about the future direction of PPS and PGS. Remember, the acid test for us in all of these things is whether they will allow more land to come through the system and enable us to deliver the government's objective, with which we're totally aligned, of constructing 200,000 homes a year. But equally, we as an industry must face up to our new responsibilities and adapt to changing conditions, particularly on the environment agenda. Few domestic issues are or ever will be as important as housing. It is about social justice. It is about economic growth. It's about quality of life and future living standards, and about meeting the aspirations of our children and their children. It places a pretty large premium, I think, and I'm sure you'd agree, on getting it right. Thank you very much.